If you're going to a solid Lutheran church that does the liturgy where the historic worship is used, if there ever was a time in the history of the West to just keep doing it, this is that time.
Dr. Rod Rosenblatt of the White Horse Inn radio show.
Because the ones in collapsing evangelicalism are going to start looking to Rome or Eastern Orthodoxy or a blown-out Episcopal church, looking for something historical rather than just experiential. And I want us to be one of the markets that they bump into.
You can meet and hear Rod Rosenblatt June 14th and 15th at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 14th and 15th in Collinsville, Illinois.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Friday, June the 7th. The last time I was talking with Pastor Clement Preuss, he ended our conversation leaving this interviewer wanting a little bit more. He used an analogy of between the evangelist and a parent, the kind of patience that a parent needs to exercise with his children when he is day by day dealing with their questions and their problems and all of those things, is a good analogy to the patience that an evangelist might need. Part two of our six-part series on the task of an evangelist today. Before someone will listen to the message of Christ, sometimes you need to answer their objections on particular issues. Not all of them, but some of them you really need to get out of the way. Joining us for this series on the task of an evangelist, Pastor Clement Preuss, pastor of Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota, and author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, What They Need to Hear, Sharing Christ with Family and Friends. Clem, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Last time we talked, you ended with, I thought, an analogy we didn't have time to get into, but an analogy between the long-term task of parenting, parents working with their kids, and the long-term task that may be this kind of evangelism. What's the connection there?
Well, I mean, I'm a parent of four kids, and one of the things parents learn, I imagine every parent learns this, is that you don't have to teach your kids everything about life in one sitting. You live with them, you teach them the lessons of life and the lessons of God as life goes along. And so it's a process of parenting which lasts as long as God keeps you on this earth. And so the process of evangelism, of telling a person about Jesus, can be the same way. It's a conversation which can be interrupted but for a month or two at a time, a year or two, and then can be picked up later on. And we don't have to rush it. Parents who insist that their kids know more than they're able to know at a given time end up frustrating their kids. Also, what happens is that this is very common in the ministry. Kids go to Sunday school, kids go to catechism class, they go to high school Bible class because their parents are in the adult class. They go away to college and their parents aren't cracking the whip anymore, and they kind of stop going to church. They stop going to Bible class. They know their Bible and their Christian doctrine at around a 16-year-old level, and they go to college, and all of a sudden they're absorbing all sorts of stuff, and they come home and their parents listen to them, and they're spouting stuff about evolution. They're spouting stuff about, the Da Vinci Code and other silly attacks against Christianity. And their parents are alarmed. And rather than calm down, engage the children in a conversation, allow them to express themselves, sit back, take a deep breath, and realize maybe I need to do a little study to answer my kids here and read a book or two, the parents say, well, this isn't what you've been taught. You need to believe in Jesus Christ. And they pretty much force Christ upon the kids, which then these college-age kids, they're not taking it anymore. They think they found a better way. And in a certain sense, it fulfills a prophecy which their unbelieving professors have given, at least implicitly, and that is that parents really don't know it all. And kids are kind of at a rebellious stage there. And I think parents need to just kind of go with it. I mean, obviously say, I disagree with you and I think you're wrong, but don't insist that the conversation has to be resolved today and that the kids, out of obedience to their parents, need to accept Jesus as their Savior. Recognize these kids are being tempted and do what you can to figure out a way to mitigate the temptation and to bring them back into the fold of Christ.
I mean, actually, we're not just using an analogy there. We're really talking about another form of what we've been discussing here so far. This is, as you said before in our last conversation, avocational
right.
evangelism, where who are the neighbors to the parents? Their kids.
Exactly, and often, I mean, you've been a pastor. This is heartbreaking when parents say, my kid isn't a believer anymore. They've rejected Jesus, and they think he's just a pious story, and I don't know what to say. And my answer is, well, let's figure out exactly what's a good thing to say. I mean, you got to say something. You can't just say, well, it's okay. They're lost eternally. They're going to hell, but they're a good kid anyhow. No Christian parent's going to do that. So we need to devise a strategy to speak to our kids, whatever their unbelief is. So sometimes it's an unbelief of indifference where their life is just too busy and they don't go to church anymore. Sometimes it's a considered unbelief where they have really come across a worldview they think is better than Christianity. In those cases, the parents need to learn that worldview. They need to understand what their kids believe as best they can so they can refute it to some extent. It's why I said last session, too, that sometimes evangelism becomes an argument. But don't do the parent thing and don't do the mom and dad thing and say, well, you got to do this. Tell the kid, you know, let's have a talk about this. We'll talk a little bit now. We'll talk about it a little bit later. Life is long. This conversation can go for 25 or 30 years.
I've had this actually happen with both of my kids. I mean, at one time or another, not just raising questions or doubts, but saying, you know, I don't really know if I buy this anymore. And I remember the first time it happened years ago, I had that kind of flash of parental panic.
Right. Parental panic. That's a good word.
And here's this guy that does this for a living. You know, I do it every day for 2 hours for a living. And suddenly I'm sitting there in the kid's bedroom thinking, what in the world do I say? And then just, you know, finally common sense kicks in and you say, well, what exactly, I mean, you just ask a question. What exactly is it that you're rejecting here? First, I want to know, Clem, are they really rejecting Christianity or are they just, do they have a particular question that's getting in the way?
Well, right. And you won't know the answer to that until you ask them. I mean, I've known parents who think their kids are rejecting Christianity when they're just mad at the church because the church did some boneheaded thing. Or they're mad at the church because the church does a good thing that they don't quite understand yet. And that's a teaching moment. But I've also known parents whose kids come back and say, creation is a myth. It's just believed by weak-minded people. Evolution is the truth. And according to evolution, humanity is no better than the dolphins and the chimpanzees. And you got to have an answer for that one, too. And that's a longer, more cerebral kind of conversation, but a conversation that parents need to have.
We spoke earlier about your father-in-law, Lloyd, to whom you had written a long, long series of letters before his death in this kind of ongoing conversation. What were some of his particular initial objections that you needed to come up with answers for?
Well, his first objection was he didn't believe in miracles. He particularly didn't believe in the virgin birth. And so before I talked to him about the atonement and Christ's forgiveness, I had to convince him that disbelief in miracles was irrational. That was my goal. And so I basically told him that miracles are very, very rare. Miracles don't happen every day, despite some of the miracle workers' claims today, that they appointed to Jesus' time, so that we shouldn't expect miracles all the time, but only at the time of Christ, because these miracles pointed to Christ, at both the miracles he did and the apostles did. So I narrowed the definition of miracle to those events which happened at Christ's time and by his apostles. And I define miracle as suspending the laws of nature. And then I said to him, you can't expect these kind of miracles in your day. It's not going to happen. But if God did want to bring attention to the coming of his son, what could he do but break the laws of nature? How else would he let us know that something big is coming down? And that seemed to convince him. And then I said, I can't possibly argue the virgin birth. That's kind of he said, she said type of stuff. I mean, there's no witnesses to the Annunciation. But I said, I can demonstrate to you the reasonableness of believing the resurrection. And if I can convince you of the resurrection, I think the virgin birth will fall in line. So I gave him all the reasons why the tomb couldn't have been empty by a stolen body, or the swoon theory, and some of these ridiculous theories to explain why the tomb was empty. I finally said, the best explanation is that Christ actually rose from the dead, which, of course, you will reject if you're so close-minded you don't even believe in the possibility of miracles. Then, of course, you've already decided that you won't believe that. And I did convince him, because he stopped arguing about miracles and went on to his next objection.
And the beauty of this, Clem, is that you really are there in answering those particular objections. You really are staying right there at the center of, in that case, in the center of the gospel message. Things like the virgin birth and the resurrection are essential to the message of Christ's atonement.
Well, right. But I also pointed out to him that believing in the virgin birth and the resurrection is not faith. It's believing that the virgin birth and the resurrection impact him, and that Christ also died for him and atones for his sins. So I made it clear that once he believes in miracles, he's still not there yet. And I think that was very helpful to him as well, because he realized faith is not, it is accepting the facts, but it's more than accepting the facts.
So part of it here is for the occasional evangelist is to realize that he's not going to get to run this conversation. The questions of the person he's talking to are going to take precedent over any agenda he may have. About a minute.
Exactly right. And you look at Jesus. I mean, he sits there talking with the woman at the well. She gets to run the conversation. And then towards the end of the conversation, if you recall, I mean, this is the Samaritan woman, and, you know, she's got her act together, and he finally says to her, go get your husband, and he takes over the conversation. But after, not at first. At first, she gets to determine where the conversation goes, and she still tries after that to determine where it goes. And finally, he just makes the assertion, and that's kind of encapsulizing what the evangelistic task is. It's more listening and more kind of feeling your way than it is giving a canned presentation like you would at someone's door in 30 seconds.
Pastor Clement Preuss is our guest. He's pastor of Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota, author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June, What They Need to Hear, Sharing Christ with Family and Friends. When we come back, now, of course, objections should be answered. All in due time. Sometimes you can't answer every single one in one conversation. But there are times when someone to whom you may be bearing witness has objections that are not intended to elicit honest answers from you. There are times when someone might object or raise theological issues or a doctrinal question of this or that or some question about the Bible because they want to distract you. They want to distract you from getting to the real point of sharing Christ, which is Christ himself. It happens. We all know this happens. They want to have a theological conversation. It's much more comfortable having a theological conversation than actually getting down to brass tacks and talking about the crucified and risen Jesus. So what do you do in that case? Pastor Clement Preuss is our guest. It's part two of a six-part series on the task of an evangelist. Today, before someone will listen to the message of Christ, their objections to the message should be addressed. When we come back, we'll talk more with Pastor Clement Preuss, and then in about 10 minutes, Bobby Rush Jr. joins us to talk about media coverage of the Boy Scouts' decision to admit homosexual members. Stay tuned.
The message is the mission. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Trinity Orchard Farm is settled between two rivers showing the way to the water of life. For worship that is reverent, relevant, and refreshing like pure water, or for excellent education in a unique setting, check out our church and school. We're just 5 miles north of Highway 370 on Highway 94 in St. Charles County. Visit us on the web at trinityorchardfarm.com. That's trinityorchardfarm.com. Our phone number is 636-250-3350.
Do you struggle to reach out to friends or family members who have questions about Christianity? Well, we have just the resource for you. It's a new book titled What They Need to Hear, Sharing Christ with Family and Friends. It's written by regular guest Pastor Clement Preuss. What They Need to Hear is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. What They Need to Hear, The Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for June. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Friday, June the 7th. Part two of a six-part series on the task of an evangelist with Pastor Clement Preuss. Today we're talking about answering objections. Sometimes that needs to happen when undertaking the task of the evangelist. Sometimes you need to answer a few objections first. A little bit later, Bobby Rausch Jr. of GetReligion.org will be our guest. We'll talk about media coverage of the Boy Scouts of America's decision to admit homosexual members. And then we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. And on this Friday, something a little different. We're also giving away, in addition to the LPR bundle package, a free registration to the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference coming up in 1 week when we play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week in about a half hour. Clem, before the break, we were talking about answering objections that people may raise. But are there times when people raise objections or questions, not so much to get an honest answer, but just to kind of keep a theological conversation going in order to avoid the gospel, in order to avoid Jesus?
I've had that happen to me many times, both with parishioners and with potential parishioners. Well, you go visit somebody who thinks interested in your church, and after a while you get the idea. He's just throwing at you all sorts of half-considered protestations to Christianity. And when I sense that happening, I go, let's get down to brass tacks. Do you think you're going to go to heaven someday? I go back to that Kennedy question. If you were to die tonight, you're going to go to heaven. Or something like that, where it gets it right real personal with that person. But it's a risky thing to do because you may be wrong. They may actually have these heartfelt feelings. If you go straight to the kind of a hardcore presentation of the gospel, they're going to feel that you're insensitive, and it is a bit insensitive. But it's kind of like raising kids again, though. When your kids, after a while, you can tell when your kids are just pestering you with questions because they don't want to deal with something that they should be, and when they're asking questions because they really want an answer from their dad, and we get to tell the difference between those in time. You know your kids.
And that's why the relationship is important.
Oh, that's the most important thing. The relationship is what keeps the conversation going. If you blow the relationship and make the other person mad or think that they're just an object for your preaching, then that evangelism becomes quite a bit more challenging. You have to reestablish a relationship where they actually believe that you think of them before you think of your quest.
Let's talk about that aspect of it, and that is that... And I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but let's talk about, they need to be convinced that they are not simply an object of your evangelism, that you're not simply trying to sell them a used car, and you really don't care who they are, or you really don't even care what they believe. You're just trying to achieve a personal goal. What are your thoughts there?
Well, and that you pretty much said it. If a person thinks that they are part of a quest, that they're a number. You've converted six people this year, and they're number seven. They won't view that as a particularly meaningful conversation. It's not that the gospel has lost its effectiveness. It's that people just aren't listening to it very well. Whereas if this is a person who you have an existing relationship with, and they know you love them, and they know you care about them, whether it's family or a close friend, then they'll be much more predisposed to listening. But it has to be done in a graceful manner. So I think that's the relationship is what keeps the conversation going, as I said before.
These misconceptions, you say, often arise from the term you use is Time Warner theology. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's, you know, inevitably, right at the Easter season, there's going to be some show on TV which tells you the real Easter story, which is probably some third century Gnostic presentation that Jesus Christ never really rose, and they'll give you all sorts of evidence. It's kind of like, you know, Spock telling you about paranormal stuff, and people are a sucker for this. And actually, my father-in-law, bless him, he was a little bit of a sucker for that. He watched it on TV and he said, "This makes a lot of sense," and he believed that Jesus' divinity was not asserted by the church until the third century, for example. And he believed that the church didn't formulate the canon of Scripture until the third century. So I had to stop telling him about Jesus for a while and defend the canon of Scripture and present to him the history of the church and show him that not only did the church confess Jesus as God in the first century and during the life of the apostles, but that the detractors of the church accused the Christians of worshiping this false god who they called Jesus. And this was in the first century or early second century. And it took me two or three letters to convince him that this Time Warner theology is rubbish and doesn't stand up in anybody's academic field. And he was an intelligent enough guy that he actually got it. And so then I said, good, we're done with that. Now let's go on, and I'll teach you some theology here and speak Christ more directly.
Does that mean you actually had to maybe crack a book in order to answer some of those objections?
Yeah, actually, I was laughing at my class the other day, my Bible class, because I told him I had this book, and in The Fire and the Staff, which is another book I wrote, I probably had 500 footnotes. In this book, I had 6. But that doesn't mean I wasn't studying, and I had to research and read Pliny the Younger and Josephus and some of the early church historians to find out exactly what I just said. When was the Christian church recognized as worshiping Christ? And I even wrote to Lloyd and said, you know, I'm not arguing here who's right and wrong. I'm just arguing here what people believed. The fact that people were writing against Christianity in the late first century indicates that Christianity was a force. You don't write against things that aren't forces. And this was convincing to Lloyd. But if a parent is talking to their kid about Jesus and the kid comes home and says he believes in evolution, they may not want to read a couple evolution books. They may actually read books they don't agree with and don't like to find out what their kid believes, because they have to talk intelligently with them. And that may take some time, but we're talking eternities at stake for your kids. So invest a few hours or a couple days in learning about them. I mean, I remember my daughter came home once, and she's heavy into postmodernism, and I had to read not just, you know, books against postmodernism like we all have in our library, but in Gene Veith's book and others, but I had to actually read some of the postmodern philosophers so that I could have an intelligent conversation with her. And it was an unpleasant, well, actually it was fairly stimulating, but I'm sitting there reading this not because I want to, but because my daughter needs me to talk to her intelligently.
Does it help to simply ask of someone before you start a conversation about what you believe, about what the Bible teaches, about what the gospel is, to ask that person, what do you believe?
Oh, yeah, I think that's very important. And it's usually not, it's in a context. There's no, it's not a context. Without a context. So you're talking about, you know, you're having a beer after bowling with your best friend, and you're talking about something that comes up. And then you say, what do you believe about? Let's say you're talking about a social issue, about abortion, about something like that. What do you believe? And this isn't about Christ necessarily, but what they say about it. If they say, well, I think life is sacred, now you got something to build on. Oh, so we're important. What makes life sacred? Well, God. Well, now you're getting somewhere in a conversation. What do you believe about God and about life being sacred? And you can kind of move them to be more revealing about their deepest conviction. People don't like to share what they believe. They think that any talk about politics and religion is inherently divisive, and they've been learned not to talk that way. But that's not the case. We may make it divisive, but it's not divisive in and of itself. So you can draw people out to reveal what they really believe and then have a conversation.
So just in terms of your actual experience that you write about in the book, how long was it before, you certainly had spoken the gospel many times beforehand, as you said before, but how long was it before in the course of your correspondence that you got past some of these initial objections?
Oh, I would say I could look it up in the book real quick here, but you're looking for a real quick answer. Probably a third of the way through, he stopped with the objections. Another episode that happened is that we had an evangelist came by from a fundamentalist church and was telling him that he had to surrender to Jesus, and so I had to interrupt all the conversations to take a couple pot shots at evangelicalism. But I would say maybe 30 to 35 letters into it, he finally, I think, was convinced that his protestations to Christ were probably not without solid foundation. They were not with solid foundation, I should say. And I think that was a type of repentance where he realized, I'm not what I believe is not right. And that was a harsh law preacher. I mean, he preached the law to himself, realizing that he was wrong. And then he started going back to church, and that's when I could start speaking very, very directly about Christ. It was very rewarding because I kind of wanted to do that all along, and I'm stuck doing this peripheral stuff. And then when you finally get to tell them about Jesus, it's exhilarating.
Does it kind of show a good relationship between evangelism and apologetics, that apologetics is always the servant of evangelism, that it never suffices in and of itself. About a minute here, Clem.
Yeah, and that's not pejorative towards apologetics. It's a very necessary discipline, and sometimes apologetics is necessary. Apologetics being defending the truth of the gospel and the truth of the Bible without the Bible, through history and geology and whatever. That's necessary sometimes, but that is never, ever able to convert. What brings a person to Christ is the gospel, but apologetics destroys the objections to listening to the gospel. And I think that's what happened with my father-in-law, Lloyd. There was a lot of apologetic stuff in the first 30 letters, and then after that, it kind of disappears.
Pastor Clement Preuss is pastor of Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota. He's author of The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June, What They Need to Hear, Sharing Christ with Family and Friends. You can find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and ask them about The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June, What They Need to Hear by Pastor Clement Preuss, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Next time, in part three of our series on the task of an evangelist, we're going to talk with Pastor Clement Preuss about objections that are not usually stated unless a level of trust is achieved. That's next time. Clem, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Look forward to next time.
When we come back, Bobby Ross Jr. will be our guest. We're going to talk about media coverage of the decisions that's been made by the Boy Scouts to admit homosexual members. Stay tuned.
Do you have a student finishing up eighth grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The Virtual Organist Service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Can God save people any way he wants? Is Jesus the only way we know of? I've written an article for the latest Issues, Etc. journal titled, What God Cannot Do. You can read it by subscribing to the Issues, Etc. journal. Just look for the subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor John Fraser details his journey from the subjective introspection of decision theology to the objective saving work of Jesus. The online Issues Etc. journal.
The Lord has gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. These gifts can be received every week at both Grace Lutheran Church and Trinity Lutheran Church in Wichita, Kansas. Join us for divine services at Grace on Sundays at 8 a.m. and 4:30 p.m., as well as every Wednesday at 11 a.m., or at Trinity every Sunday at 11 a.m. Grace is located at 3310 East Pawnee and Trinity at 611 South Erie. Gather with us around our Lord and His giving His gifts to us. See you soon.